Well, folks, we have an interesting show tonight. We're going to have on the telephone a man named Red Wimette. Red Wimette was, some people would call him an informant. Really, basically, he was a contract undercover agent for the FBI. He wasn't a sworn agent, but he would be more like a contract undercover agent for the FBI in Chicago. And you Google the name Red Wimette and Frank Sweese, S-C-H-W-E-I-S-H, I think, and there's some fantastic YouTube videos out there of him recording this Frank the German Sweese as a Chicago outfit guy who was shaking down all the porn shops in the area.
300 Quaker, probably in the block, up at
2-0. Oh, they turned the key.
Okay, I'm a northbound actor. He's right at the light.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on a donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. It's nice to be back here in the deep, dark confines of the Ice House and fabulous studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
This is quite a story. He's got a book, Nobody Cares, and What I Did About It. And if you know anything about the Chicago outfit and their relationship with governmental agencies in the Chicago Police Department and even more the Cook County Sheriff's Department, then if the FBI wasn't doing anything about it, nobody was doing anything about it. So we're going to talk to Red tonight, and you want to look for his book, Nobody Cares and What I Did About It, is out there. I think you can get it on Amazon, or you can go to his website.
You can get a personal autographed copy at redwemette.com, redwemette.com. Or it's available at Amazon. It's also available at the Barnes & Noble.
Oh, good. Now, is it a downloadable Kindle book also?
No, it's not in Kindle.
Okay. Red, I want to talk to you a little bit about when you first hooked up with the FBI. Now, in my little promo before, I explained to people that, you know, some people might say you were an informant, but you were really more than an informant. You were more like a contractor undercover agent, from what I gathered out of your book. How did you first get connected up with the FBI in Chicago?
I was tending bars at outfit places, tending bar, and they rotate me from one place to another place, but they're all outfit places. And there was an agent by the name of John Osborne. He was coming in and trying to get information from different people that worked there, bartenders, about the people that owned the places and who their bosses were, and et cetera, et cetera. And we were all told, you know, you do not talk to these people. You'd be polite to them, but you just walk away. Well, I never had the problem. Nobody ever came to me. I just walked to the other side of the bar. But somebody came in, and a bartender that was there, he took his business card, said thank you. The guy walked away, and he threw it in the garbage can. I picked it up, put it in my pocket. I decided to give the guy a call, and I did. After he ran a background check on me, I gave my real name and everything. He set up a background check on me and did some things to me, and I called him back a second time. We didn't have caller ID in those days, but I called him back, and he said he'd like to set up a meet. So I told him I wanted it on my terms, and I met him at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago. He did not know what I looked like. I knew what he looked like because he was wearing white socks and wing-tip shoes. He stood out like a sore thumb.
Really? Wingtip shoes. I think there's a chapter in a book by Ken Kesey called FBI Wingtip Shoes or something like that. So, yeah, that was uniform of the day for those guys back then. It was definitely a white shirt and little skinny tie, too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. J. Edgar Hoover insisted upon it.
I remember that. You met him, and you offered to help him.
He really didn't know, except he knew that I rotated around between the B-Girl bars on Rush Street and, you know, the downtown nightlife area.
Just general intelligence?
In the very beginning, he just wanted, you know, he wanted an insight because nobody would talk to him. Nobody would talk to him. And they whisked me out the back door. He had an agent by the back door. And they whisked me out the back door and brought me to a suburb that there was, it was Evanston, Illinois. It's right outside of Chicago. But there was nobody, no outfit presence there at all.
At that point in your life, what outfit guys did you know? Did you really know any outfit guys, or just they'd come into a bar where you were working at? So at least you could say, this is so-and-so and that's so-and-so?
Not at all. I knew quite a few people. I knew Jimmy Katura way before I ever went to work on the north side. Jimmy Katura took over it was a battle at those days, but he was in the chop shop business on the south side of Chicago, and Fifi LaPorte was out there. Frankie LaPorte, Fifi they called him. But at any rate, I knew those guys and several other people that were low level.
You could tell Osborne something like Jimmy Kutera, and he's involved in the chop shop business. That would be a valuable little tidbit. It doesn't really put anybody in jail.
Aside from that, Jimmy sent me out to Las Vegas once to bring a package back. He paid for everything. And I did, and he was real curious about that. John Osborne was.
Oh, I'll bet.
And I never did look inside of it to see what it was. I assume it was money.
Yeah. So how'd that work? What hotel or what casino did you go to when you went to Las Vegas?
I stayed as a guest of the under Mr. Smith, by the way, at the Stardust Hotel.
You remember who you talked to? Did you talk to Lefty Rosenthal when you were there?
No, I did not. I didn't meet Rosenthal until after I moved to, after we arrested Schweiss, and I moved to Palm Beach. And Rosenthal lived in Boca Raton, and they came out with the movie Casino. He went on, the news cameras were out there and everything on his front porch and everything else, and that's when the first time I saw Lefty. But then I talked to him when he was working down in Miami later on, before he passed away.
Can you tell us who gave you the package?
I didn't know the guy's name, and everybody talked in, we have this friend of ours. You know, we both have a mutual friend. I was winning at the gaming tables, and I sat down to get something to eat, and a man sat down next to me, and he said, we have a mutual friend who likes shoes. And that was Jimmy Katura.
He just
had 100 pairs of shoes in his closet. That's how, you know.
Pretty slick.
I did not get his name.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
I said, yeah, that's pretty slick. What you don't know, you can't tell anybody.
But you could. So you actually could have just been flying up to Vegas to bring back a pair of shoes.
I didn't fly. I drove. Oh. They insisted I drive.
No record that way.
And Jimmy the way it worked was Jimmy turned around and said to me, he said, how would you like a trip on me out there? And he said, it was expensive. And I added it up, and I said, what do you want? And I said, would you like me to bring you back anything? And he said, yeah. He said, bring me back a nice pair of shoes. And believe it or not, those are the shoes I saw in the news clip that he was murdered in on Ogden and Hubbard.
Interesting.
The same shoes.
So in your book...
It was at the time.
Yeah, so in your book, you talk about a street tax. Can you explain that to people, what that means, and with the Chicago outfit, a street tax?
They come along and look at a business, and they see if it's making money. If it's a gray line business, J. generally speaking, in the old days, I don't know what they do now, but in the old days, if it was a gray line business, like an after-hours bar, a gay bar, a bookstore, when I say a pornography shop or something like that, they would go in and they'd want 50%. That's it.
Wow.
They want half of it.
Half?
And if you don't give them half of it, they're going to break your legs or kill you.
Well, half of your weekly take or your profit or half of...
Half of the gross.
Half of the gross. Boy, that's pretty
half of the
tax.
Gross.
What did they provide for that? I guess they provided... They kept you safe from being beat up or maybe having a Molotov cocktail thrown in there. What did they give you any protection from law enforcement if you're in a kind of a gray line business, you porn shop, or you maybe had some prostitutes that were working out of there?
They would tell you they would, but the truth of the matter is they really didn't. And as Irv Weiner told me in the very beginning, when he's the one that told me to open up the shop and run this other guy out of business because they were in there from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
And they didn't have permission. They just snuck in.
Yeah, that was
so.
That was,
he told me, he said, open up a shop right next to him.
That was the porn shop. So describe what does that mean? A porn shop? That's kind of a general term. To what like you had what
well,
we call dirty books.
It's triple X rated. It's adult books, and at that time we had peep shows in the back room. Where the 8mm that were quiet, they didn't have talkies on.
Yeah.
But
this
people
goes way
used
back.
To go in there and watch them.
Can you tell us kind of what year that was then? You opened up it would be basically your first porn shop in Chicago?
I built it in 73, and I actually opened up September, Labor Day weekend of 1974.
Now, you did this at the behest of, was it Jimmy Cutera? Or no, it was Irv Weiner. Now,
Jimmy, I went to Jimmy for a blessing, so to speak, and he told me, he said, at that time I was doing slot machines out by El Pilato, out in the south side, and they threw us out. But he said, go see Joey on the north side. He's a good boy. He'll take care of you.
Yeah.
He spoke broken English.
So that was Joey. Would that be Joey Lombardo?
That's correct, sir.
And they call him Joey the Clown or Lumpy, and you always called him JL. Is that's if I remember you telling me that?
That's right. I did call him JL. I never called him Lumpy. A lot of guys that, like Frank Schweiss, they would call him Lumpy. Joe Palooka, they called him all the time. He liked to box.
Oh, really?
He was a good boxer.
He looked like, he's got a face like a boxer,
yeah.
That's for sure. So you, when you...
Well, he had a stout build to him, too.
Yeah, he looked pretty tough. He looked like a pretty heavy guy.
So you opened your first porn shop there in Chicago, right next to the guy from Cleveland. How long did it take you to run him out of business?
I never did, and that's an interesting story right there. They had some air conditioning units that were dripping on my property, and what I used to do is go out and take a hatchet and break the coils. They would call somebody in New York or in Cleveland that would call somebody in New York, and they would call somebody in Chicago, and the guy would come out and he'd scream at me in front of them and say, don't you ever, all kinds of stuff. And the first time he did it, it scared me. And I went to Joey and he just laughed. He thought it was funny. But JL sent me on my way, said, forget about it. And then the second time it happened, whoever they sent out came over to me and he chewed me out again, but he whispered to me on the side, he said, keep doing this. He said, there's $500 for you every time you do it.
That probably meant...
He wanted to cut up the money with me.
Right, that probably meant that...
Pardon me?
That probably meant that guy who you were jacking with probably had to pay to get them come out and take some kind of enforcement action, and they were willing to split that with you if you'll keep it up. Would that be a correct assessment?
That is correct, sir. I just laughed about it. At first it bothered me, but later on when he told me that, he said, keep it up. I thought that was kind of odd.
Well, so that was your first porn shop. You open it up. They're telling you you have to pay street tax.
Well, basically what they said was, we'll open this up with a partnership. And it was Marshall Cofano, myself, He had a guy that was working for him that was in prison with him, Johnny Rogers, Alva Johnson Rogers. And he was basically the carpenter or whatever. He really did not do many things. I did most of it myself. It was a deal that was set up beforehand with permission. Irv Weiner kind of orchestrated it, and Joey was in charge.
So they help you
and then
get
Marshall was in charge.
Right. They help you get the building and even a little bit. You worked on it as like a carpenter and you fixed it all up. And so what happened?
No, I went out and got the building on my own. That's what Irv told me to do, Irv Weiner. He said, go get the nearest place to them and run them out of business. I had worked for them at one time and they owed me money. And Irv went in and collected it for me because they wouldn't give it to me.
Now, Irv Weiner, I've heard that name. What was his status, shall we say, in the Chicago outfit at this point in time?
Very, very high. I mean, extremely high. He was close friends with Jimmy Hoffa. That's how I met Jimmy Hoffa, was through him. Also, he was a bondsman at American Bonding, is where I met all these guys at American Bonding, except Keturah. He used to go down to Cuba and when they had gambling down there, and he goes way back. I mean, way, way back. And he underwrote bonds, different kinds of bonds for different things. But he also financed with Hoffa through the Diplomat Hotel. They met Diplomat in Miami, and they financed Circus Circus. I don't know who was on the name on the license there, but the skim, which is like a reward fee or anything,
right,
it went to the Chicago outfit. They were trying to launder the money, and Irv was involved in that very heavy. But he was also involved with Jack Ruby and a lot of other people. So
interesting.
It's very complicated.
Yeah,
very complicated.
That circus, they got that thing going. They needed the Teamsters money. They needed a big loan, and a guy named Jay Sarno had it. And he was kicking back through a guy named Carl Thomas was his main guy that was skimming money and sending it back. And Alan Dorfman was somehow in that mix also. I think he was kind of the guy that...
Alan Dorfman was on the Teamsters Pension Loan Fund. Jimmy Hoffa actually set it up, though. But Alan Dorfman did the actual loan. He approved it. Head of the board.
Okay, I knew he was in that mix somewhere. Interesting. So, Irv Weiner, he would not have been what we call a made guy, whereas Joey Lombardo or JL, he was like had his own crew at that point in time, several guys working for him.
He was a capo. He was a capo at the time. He had his own crew, but it was called the Grand and Ogden crew. But Irv was like nationwide. I mean, he'd go out to California, he'd go anywhere, he'd go see Roselli, Johnny Roselli. He was involved with a lot of different people, and he was the money maker. He was the cash cow. This guy had brains. He was the banker.
It's interesting. Like, you had Mayor Lansky back east, the Jewish guy who helped the mob, the New York mob, make money. And then in Kansas City, we had a guy named Snag Klein, and he was the money guy, and not really, you know, he was in and around all the time, but he helped him make him money, but he was not a made guy. And they never really did that direct criminal behavior like the soldiers and the capos and all that did.
The only time that I believe that Weiner was indicted was on the Teamsters pension skim, when they were doing that, and he was brought before a Senate hearing committee on the death of JFK.
Yeah, I read some stuff on the internet about that. It's there's a lot of supposition in that. I don't know. It's that's one of those political roads that I never like to go down. Anyhow, you'll never figure it out. We did.
Well, it's not really good to go into.
Yeah, I did a little studying up on Sam Giancana and his connection to some of those early assassination attempts on Castro. That was kind of interesting. I think that was all scam on his part, and he took a bunch of money and wasn't really going to do anything. But that's a typical mob deal. Is, you know, give me a, I can do a whole lot of stuff for you.
They did seek out people. They did seek out people to do something, and they couldn't get it accomplished.
Couldn't get it done. Interesting.
It just didn't work. No. As a matter of fact, I was approached about it because when I was in the Marine Corps, I was stationed at Guantanamo Bay. And
oh, really?
I was approached about it, but I just said, forget it. You can't get to him. There's no way. Castro, he had prisoners that would taste his food for him first. I mean, there was no way to get to this guy.
Yeah.
The University of Chicago came out with this cyanide cigar, and it was supposed to be snuck into him, and I didn't see any way possible. I just looked at him and laughed. I said, there's no way. But they wanted to give up a million in cash just to get it done so they could get Cuba back.
So going back to Chicago outfit and stuff more like directly on the street, you are running your porn shop, you're paying a street tax, and it was set up by Irv Wiener, who is closely connected to Joey Lombardo, and he's kind of, is he kind of your guy? You know, if you would be a mob associate who would be an associate of Joey Lombardo and his crew, would that be
that is correct
the way to characterize you and your relationship? And then Frankie Swish. What was he? He was a German, so he wasn't Italian. He wasn't a member of La Cosa Nostra or the mob
No.
Would he have been a sworn member?
He was Joey's right arm. He was Joey's bulldog. He, you know, if Joey pointed, the guy was dead. That was it.
So he was mainly
all the hits he made. I mean,
he was mainly strong arm and muscle Lombardo. What would be an example of what Frankie Swish would do for Lombardo?
They would meet usually at a construction zone because you couldn't use a parabellum mic there, and they'd cover their faces and they'd talk, and he would tell them to go someplace and do something, and he would go there and do it. And on many occasions, I was aware of it just before it was going to happen, and I did report some of the things into the FBI, but they couldn't follow them, and they tried to, and the murders took place anyway.
You were running just one porn store at this point in Chicago, or did you have multiple stores?
No, I only had one store. I had unlimited credit with anybody in California. I had my own production company in California at the time. I had plans of expanding throughout the United States, but they were false plans. They were just to get to other people. It's just like I purchased all my video equipment when we went to video from MCA Video Arcade in Kansas City, Missouri. And a guy that owned a piece of that was Meyer Lansky.
So you still kept all your business like within the outfit or the organization?
I was suffering from agoraphobia. I don't know if you know what that is or not, but
fear of open spaces.
I had panic attacks. I had panic attacks a lot, so I really kind of stayed close to home as much as I could.
Do you think that was resulting from the stress of kind of living that double life, being this double agent that you were at the time, or would you had to have that anyhow?
Actually, it was a triple life. I got one of the best doctors I could get. Believe me, I went to UCLA Medical Center, Harvard Medical Center, and I got a guy at, I didn't get him, John Osborne got him for me, Special Agent John Osborne, and they debriefed him and ran a background on him. He called me up on the phone and told me what I'd like to, I needed help, and I said, yes, I do. He came in and saw me, and we started talking things out. We later found out it was genetic.
Oh, really?
It was genetic. It was a genetic defect in me.
Yeah.
I have a hot spot on the base of my brain. Huh. One of the things that they overlooked was the fact that one of my parents was epileptic. That's kind of what caused it.
Now, let's go back to Frankie Swish. There's some videos out there, I think some of them are on YouTube, that of you talking with Frankie Swish and him bragging about all the things he's done. How did that come about?
When Joey went away to prison, we had a meeting. A bunch of us got together. There must have been 40, 50 guys there. And Joe was giving orders. JL said to Frankie, he said, you take care of that kid, no matter what he needs, take care of him. So when he left, he turned it over to Louis Eboli, the day-to-day operation. And Louis Eboli was Louis the Mooch. Other guys that I knew, like Jimmy Cozzo and people like that, they couldn't get anything done with this guy. He was just, you know, not very good. So he assigned a guy to me, but name of Dodino. We called him Jeeps. His name was Tony Dodino, Anthony Dodino. He would come around to collect for me. I kept telling him I wanted to speak to Frank because I wanted to expand. It was a ruse, you know, and I finally got to talk. I got to the point where I told Jeeps, don't come by here no more. Don't come by here. I don't want to see you. Don't come by here no more. I said, I'm tired of giving you messages back and forth month after month. It's been over a year. I want to talk to Frank. And Frank came into town and talked to me.
You got him to just sit and chat with you after that. It looked to me like he must have liked you and liked
actually,
to come back and brag to you.
No, he liked me. He liked me like a son, I swear to God. He came and rang the bell, and I was really surprised when he showed up. And I let him in. As I talked to him, I said, what are you doing in town? I said, I've been looking for you. And I started screaming at him. I mean, really screaming at him. He started laughing. He thought it was funny, and he said, I heard there were some deadbeats that didn't want to pay up. And so I said, what are you drinking? And I went over to the bar, gave him a drink, and he sat down in a chair, and we talked it all over. And he said, well, Louis got cancer. He's dying. He said, when he's gone, he said, then you and I are going to be partners. That's it. Just you and me.
Oh, good. So now you lived at your place because of your agoraphobia. Would you live upstairs above your store?
That is, I built that place above the store. I lived in the apartment building next door that I owned also. I owned a great deal of real estate. I built that place above it custom. I actually built it custom just for me. It was a four-bedroom, very large dining room, kitchen, laundry room, maid's quarters, living room. It was nice. It was very nice.
So is that where you entertained Frank and you installed the video cameras and audio equipment?
Yes, I did. I had a rear projection TV. I don't know if you know what that is, but I put the camera inside the TV so it would look directly at the chair. And so he was looking at the entertainment center. And I put I think it was a 7mm mic. Very small, but half the size of an eraser tip on a pencil on top of the entertainment center. You couldn't even notice it. And he would just sit there and talk to me for hours and hours and hours and talk about everything underneath the sun.
And this is a material that you were collecting for the FBI?
That's correct.
They
were very excited about this.
They should have been very happy with you. That's the kind of stuff that's really hard to get a mob guy just to relax and just chat and shoot the breeze and brag a little bit about some of his scores.
But they were never suspicious of you for being a snitch?
In no way whatsoever. As a matter of fact, Frank felt so comfortable in my apartment on several occasions. He said, I had a partner at the time that was, taking care of my legwork on the street, and he would tell him to go take a walk. Then I would talk to Frank alone. But sometimes when I needed cash to give Frank or something like that, I would send for him, and he would have to give the cash to me, and then I would give it to Frank. Frank would not take the money out of his hand.
Yeah, that's smart. That's pretty smart on Frank's part, actually. He trusted you. He didn't know that other guy.
Except it was all on videotape.
Yeah, well, and Frank did the best he could. You know, Frank, the German, he was, God, wasn't he, didn't he take part in the Dorfman murder? And wasn't he a pretty important hitman up there in Chicago?
All over the nation, really. Frank was what we define as a signature killer. His signature was one shot in the leg and seven in the head, and he always used a .22 Colt Woodsman.
Interesting. No, that wasn't Sam Giancana killed. He was killed with a Silence .22. I don't remember if it was a Colt Woodsman or not.
Was he shot in the leg?
He wasn't shot in the leg. He was shot in the face several times.
No, he was shot in the back of the head. He was shot in the back of the head, and then he was shot in the mouth. And that was not him. That was Tony Spilotro.
That was Spilotro. Okay, I kind of remember reading that was the prime. That came out in that Family Secret.
Well, that's
trial.
A fact. I'm going to tell you it's a
that's
fact.
A fact.
Frank and I talked it over.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Joey Lombardo and Frank Suisse, doesn't seem like there's a famous story out there where they were staking somebody out and the police pulled up on them. Do you remember that one?
If you're talking about John Flood's story, John Flood was a Cook County deputy sheriff that we just passed like ships of the night between us when I was younger. He came up on him in Niles. Frank was about to brain this guy with a lead pipe. Joey was in the car, according to John, which he testified at the sentencing hearing for Schweiss. He got out of his car and told him to produce some ID, and Frank didn't want to produce any ID. He was stalling him, and then all of a sudden this LTD Ford with Lombardo sped at the both of them. He was going to run a meltdown, according to John Flood's testimony. He knocked him out of the way and knocked him down, and they couldn't really do anything, but he did take Schweiss into custody. After he took him into custody, I guess there was some physical violence. He brought him to the Niles police station. They drove him to the Cook County Jail, where he made bond, and then he was found not guilty in the courts of law, and he had his record expunged.
The good old Chicago court system.
Well, that's the way it worked for everybody, including myself. If I had an employee that got arrested for something, all I had to do was call somebody, and a bailiff or the clerk, or if it was a jury trial, all you had to do is go to waive your right to a jury trial. You went to LaSalle Street Court, and you go before J.J. O'Donnell, and J.J. had his hand out there all the time. He didn't take any money, but his bailiff took it. Poor police officers went up there, and they had a bona fide arrest, but they get chewed out like they did something wrong. And it was the best trial, and they found not guilty. You can't try them twice.
Yeah, that's there's no double jeopardy.
The only one that I know of that was ever tried twice was Harry Ailman. Harry Ailman was tried twice. He worked with Frank, too, on a couple jobs.
Right.
Richard Kane. They worked with Richard Kane.
Explain who Harry Ailman was. I kind of know, but a lot of people out there don't know that name. He was a pretty important hitman for the Chicago outfit. Tell us a little bit about Harry.
Yes, he was. He was just as lethal as Frank. Just as lethal as Frank. He was Ferriero's, I believe, his son-in-law, if I'm not mistaken.
Whose son-in-law?
Joe Ferriero. They call him.
Okay, Ferriero.
Big Joe. Joe Ferriero. He had a short reign as a overboss or, head of Chicago. I think it was about a year and a half, 18 months. Frank used to call him on my phone all the time.
So
Frank never used anybody else. A phone of his own. Pick up your phone and call them.
So tell us a little more about Harry Ailman. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, he was. He certainly was.
Well, like this story about him being tried twice for murder. It was a hit that went down. Was that the gambler?
Yes,
he waived
his right to a jury, and he went before Judge Wilson. And Judge Wilson, I think it was Bob Cooley that was his attorney. Ailman's. Judge Wilson accepted a bribe of $10,000 to find him not guilty. And he did. As a result, I think it was during Greylord, Operation Greylord, they came out with indictments on judges, cops, all different things. Everybody was getting arrested. And when he got his notice, he just walked out in the backyard and put a .38 to his head and blew his brains out. The second time around, he was in prison on another charge, and I was doing a local triple homicide that happened in 1955, and Scott Cassidy at the state's attorney's office notified me that Harry was coming out, and I was kind of worried about him. He didn't stay out very long. He claimed double jeopardy, and they said that the court ruled that there was no double jeopardy because the first one wasn't a real trial. And they tried him a second time and put him away for the rest of his life.
Right.
He died in prison.
That's interesting. I remember reading a book about that Operation Greylord. That Chicago court system was just, and a lot of the cops and the bailiffs were, you know, that they were so corrupt. I think Tony Spilotro, he got found, not guilty in a murder.
Well, that was the Danny Seaford murder. The idea with Frank was, if you, you know, most of those guys, Frank was really good at what he did, but if there was a witness or something like that and he made bond, that witness would disappear. Either that or he's found dead. Yeah, so they didn't have a case.
Now tell us about that Danny Seaford murder. That was
Danny was a 29-year-old businessman, real nice guy. His father, or his uncle, excuse me, was a bookmaker, and he worked for Milwaukee Phil. Frank worked for Phil also. He was a bodyguard for Phil. They lived right next door to each other, north of Riverside. But at any rate, Danny got caught. They were laundering money from Circus Circus through his business, which is a fiberglass business. They made septic tanks and all kinds of things out of fiberglass. He bought this big plant in Bensonville, and he was doing real good, and he caught up in the IRS, CID, Criminal Intelligence Division. They were going to put him away. He was 29, and he just said, I'll roll over. I'll tell you the whole truth. They knew he was going to do it. I mean, they knew his attorney. They knew what was going to happen. And they tried to talk him out of it for like 6-7 months. And he just wouldn't do it. And the day before he was to appear in court, they had a block car set up. Are you familiar with a block car?
No. Explain that.
Well, if the police are called or something like that, this car is waiting at an intersection where he can jump out in front of it and get smashed and stop the vehicle. So they had block cars set up. It was a military-type operation. The actual two people that went in there were J.L. and Frank Schweiss. J.L. took Emma Seaford, Danny's wife, and their little son, Joseph, who was named after. Actually, he was Joey Lombardo was his godfather. But he took them into the bathroom and kind of locked them up in the office or bathroom in the back. And Frank actually put one in his leg. Put a shotgun to his head.
Well,
that was it.
Just left the wife.
He put a pistol shot in his leg.
Just left the wife and the kid. Just left the wife and the child in the closet and left then.
Well, Joey kind of tended them, and actually Joey saved their lives. I've talked to Nick Seaford, the oldest son, and he said it was real rough, and he always thought Joey did it. And I explained to him after I got in contact with him. I explained to him that he really saved his mother's life and little Joe by putting him over in the corner and letting Frank do the job.
Now, they must have been masked when they went in.
They were. And as a matter of fact, I got a big kick out of it because at that very time I was building the store. This was in 1974. It was really odd because on the television screen locally, it had a composite sketch of one of the murderers, and it looked like a charcoal sketch of Joey Lombardo with an overbite on his teeth. <You know? laughs> it looks like he sat for a portrait, and I just looked at it, and we all rolled our eyes, you know. But they were brought in on that, and there was no evidence. There was nothing. They couldn't convict him.
Yeah, and in Chicago at that point in time, even if there had been evidence, they couldn't have convicted him, I don't think. That was a pretty horrendous
probably
murder,
not.
Though, to kill a guy right in front of his family. And they were killing him. He was a government witness at the time also.
Yes, he was, but he wasn't right in front of his family. Like I said, his family was taken off to the side by Joe. Joe really kind of spared his family.
Yeah.
Normally, they should have been killed.
If it had been up to
Normally
Suisse,
they should have been killed as witnesses.
If it had been up to Suisse, they probably would have been killed.
Oh, he'd have whacked them all. He wouldn't have left anybody around.
What happened with Suisse?
After September 15th, 1988, well, actually in 1987, he went to Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, and they found a lump of cancer on his neck. And on videotape, he shows me the operation. He told me he was going to Mayo. He'd be gone for a while. You know, just put money on the side for him. When he came back, he said, I just bought myself 10 years, son. And he showed me the scar and the lump that came out. But in September 15, 1988, he went into, that's when we had him arrested for extortion on me. And that's a funny thing in itself, because I told him I didn't want to meet any more new people, period. I said, I don't want to meet anybody else. Marshall's in prison. I said, this guy's dead. That guy's dead. I said, don't send nobody around here, like Jeeps or anybody else, because I don't want to meet these people. You know, I can't take it. And so he turned around and he said, well, do you trust me? And I said, yeah, I'm here talking to you. And he said, well, give the money to me then. So that's how his lawyer, Alan Ackerman, said that was entrapment. But it didn't hold up in court because I never solicited.
When you finally surfaced as a double agent with the FBI, that's then you put Frank Sweets in jail.
That is correct, and it was the longest hearing that I know of for bond in anywhere.
Oh, that was
a two-week hearing.
That was a two-week hearing
for Frank to make bond.
You must have been sweating that one because you knew what was going to go down if he made bond, and in fact is. Even if he didn't make bond, if this came out as word on the street that you'd been an informant and working for the FBI for 18 years, they're just going to do it on principle.
Well, actually, when I made the arrest, it was kind of, well, when they made the arrest, it was kind of odd because they put me in handcuffs and I got into a car, and in less than 3 hours, I was gone. I was out of the state. I'd already bought a home in a warmer climate.
So you just moved away. You didn't go into witness protection program and change your name. You just moved away.
No, that was a press release that they gave about witness protection. But actually, I went through the undercover division of the FBI.
So even though they were taken,
they changed my whole identity and gave me. They erased everything. I mean, they erased all my school records, every picture, every photo. They erased everything on me.
This was before the internet, Red.
Yeah, this was before the internet. They couldn't do it today.
But so even though...
No. But at that time, I mean, even schools that I went to, there were no... the yearbooks and everything, there's nothing. There's nothing left on me. As I gave an interview with John Drummond, an exclusive interview in 1989, just before the trial, I told him, I said, it kind of sounds like I'm crying, like a crybaby, but I said, I don't have any future to speak of, and I had plenty of money. I said, I have no education, and I'm very confused about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
You sound like a teenage kid just coming out of high school.
Yeah. No, so even though they were...
That's about it.
Even though they were taking 50% of your gross from your business... There was so much.
It did not go that way, sir. It did not go that way. I'll tell you how it went. They used to take 50% of the peep shows in back, not the dirty magazines or adult magazines, whatever, but just the back.
All the coin
operated. And then Alva Johnson Rogers, right, coin operated. And Alva Johnson Rogers and Marshall decided on the arbitrary figure. The first take was $1,000. And he said, I want $500 a week. I don't care if you make $100,000 or if you make $2. You got to give me $500 a week. I'm not going to pick it up. Johnny Rogers is picking it up. And so I said, okay, no problem. It grew tremendously. I mean, it grew way beyond that. But Rogers was into making drugs, quaaludes, and stuff like that. And I was into making other things. I had different factories, and I had five different businesses going at one time. Rogers came to me and said, do you want to buy me out? Because he was known, they called him the hillbilly. That's what they called him. Cofano couldn't help him, really. He was just a mess. He really was. A lot of funny stories about him. Very unusual individual. But anyway, he said, do you want to buy me out? And I said, yeah, what do you want? And he said, give me $1,500. And he said, that way you only have to pay Marshall $250 because we split it up between us. And I said, $250? And I said, okay. I gave him $1,500, and then it went to $250, which went $250 a week is nothing. I mean, I was taking more than that in the cigarette machine.
So your street tax was really not all that bad. Of course, they didn't really get anything for it.
Nobody ever tried to raise it. Joey never tried to raise it. Nobody ever tried to raise it because a lot of times if they had problems, they would come to me and asked me if I knew a judge or a cop or somebody that could not appear in court or fix something for them, and I would do it. I would do whatever they did, but I also reported to the FBI.
Because you had video not
only... When Graylord came along, like 50% of those people that got arrested in Graylord were people that I was in contact with and had given information on. That's why my record's so extensive, they just don't want to show it to the public.
Did you testify in Graylord? I remember reading that book, but they turned a lawyer in that early on who really did in a lot of people in the court system.
That was Bob Cooley, and Bob Cooley was under indictment for fixing cases, and he wore a wire on Pat Marcy, who was the first ward alderman or whatever. He went all the way back to Al Capone, and he was a big fixer. I mean, he could fix anything in the city. Bob Cooley wore a wire on him, and that's kind of what started Graylord. But after that, it mushroomed. It got to, from the cop on the street to the bailiffs to the judges to the politicians, it just got everybody.
Yeah, they probably had a lot of people rolling on other people as they got into that. Now, what about Chicago today?
Well, that was the name of the game. That was the name of the game. Roll on the next guy, and we'll give you a pass.
Yep, that's how it works.
And that's what happened with Bob Cooley. He rolled. He was under indictment. He rolled and wore a wire.
Yeah, it's the first two or three people.
And he walked away with a pretty sweetheart deal.
Yeah, it's the first two or three people that get the good deal. As you get on down the line, you don't get a chance because there's nobody left for you to roll on.
But you basically left your business there in Chicago when you finally, after you had turned and they all went to trial, and it came up as you, and they didn't take you in witness protection, but you left Chicago, you left that store and just walked away?
On September 15th, 1988.
And then here I'm looking at the copyright date on your book, which is Nobody Cares and What I Did About It, The Red Wimette Story of the Chicago Outfit. Is a copyright 2016. So you're looking at 28 years about.
So what have you been doing? Yeah, all this time.
I mean, that's a long time to keep your head down. Why? You must feel a little bit safer.
Well, they
at
brought
this point.
Me back. They brought me back. They brought me back for family secrets. Mitch Mars, actually Tom Moriarty called me. He was a justice, and Tom and I were friends.
Was he an FBI agent or a U.S. attorney? What was Tom Moriarty?
No, he just worked for the Justice Department. I don't, he wasn't FBI.
Okay.
But anyway, he called me on the phone and said, Mitch wants to talk to you. And Mitch and I were friends. He was an assistant U.S. attorney. And I said, have him give me a call. And he said, he can't because he's not allowed to call you. He's not allowed to contact you. And so I said, okay. I had had some problems with several FBI agents, so he was not allowed to call me. So I gave him a call, and we talked for maybe 10, 15 minutes and about general things. And he told me, he said, I'm putting together a case. This was in 2002. He said, I'm putting together a case. And he said, I wonder if you might help me with it. And I said, sure, I'll be glad to. And as we talked, he said, do you mind if I send some investigators down to talk to you? I said, no. I said, but don't tell me they're FBI agents because I'm through with the FBI. And he said, well, they are. And he said, but I can guarantee you these guys are not going to, jerk you around or hurt you or give you a hard time. And it was Ted McNamara and Chris Mackey. And they were both gentlemen, and they treated me just like I would treat you.
What did they want out of you, Red? Just to kind of like, I know they had that Calabrese had turned, and they had a really powerful witness against a lot of people, and they cleared up a lot of murders and that the outfit was responsible for. What did they want out of you to just check the stories out?
They wanted me to authenticate different people. They wanted me to authenticate the tapes. On the tapes, one of the tapes that they showed in that courtroom was where Schweiss said, didn't Lumpy go over and straighten that guy out for you at one time? He should know better than cover you mouth than you. That made him the street boss of Chicago, and that authenticated. So basically, they wanted to get Joe Lombardo.
Yeah, they finally got him out of that. That's kind of the final nail in his coffin, was that family secrets trial.
Well, it was a nail in his coffin. He just got off parole, and he was involved in some other things, and he was kind of inactive at the time. I had spoken to him via phone several times in the 90s.
So you maintained a telephone relationship with him even after what happened with Suisse?
I didn't really maintain a relationship. I just I was concerned about reprisals.
Yeah.
And what was going to happen. And so what I did was I talked to him on payphones. Somebody else would answer the phone and give it to him. What happened was he told me, quote unquote, "You don't bother me, I don't bother you. That's it. You must have had a reason for what you did."
Well, but
I don't want to talk about it
anymore.
That
probably made you feel better. And of course, he wouldn't want to talk about it on any kind of a phone. Anything he said could be construed as extortion or intimidation of a government witness, I would imagine. But you still didn't go back
to
Chicago.
Yeah, and that's the way they looked at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would come back to him. But, you know, that's even when I ran into Marshall Cofano after he got out of prison. I ran into him in, what city was it, Fort Lauderdale, Florida? He was working with the Genovese family then. He kind of just tipped his hat as he walked past me on the sidewalk, and he didn't want no trouble with me.
Now, Lombardo and Frank Suisse both were...
I was looking for my license plates on the car, make sure they were covered and everything else. I was scared.
Yeah, I bet.
Marshall was dangerous.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That guy flipped a lot of people.
He was old school, wasn't he? He went back to, back to almost to Capone, but not quite, I would imagine. At least back to Frank Nitti came up.
He did go back to the 42 gang. He went back to the 42 gang, so...
What's the 42 gang? Sorry, I'm not...
1942.
Okay.
During World War II, 1942.
Yeah, IUPA was part of that, I believe, I remember reading.
He was. There was a great deal. Jackie Cerrone. A lot of those guys came out of that 42 gang.
I didn't really realize it was... I figured it was 42nd Block or something is why they called it the 42 gang. They called it the 42 gang because it was...
No, it was 1942. The guys that didn't go off to war, and they were convicted criminals or felons, so they were out doing what they were doing. Most of them were burglars. They burgled. You know, they stole. And eventually the mob took a piece of their action. That's how they came to power. They were called upon, instead of giving up part of their score on burglaring something, to kill somebody. And once they did that, the mob owned them. That was it.
So Joy Lombardo and Frank Suisse both became defendants in this family secrets trial.
That's correct.
And they both... Is Suisse still alive?
Frank was too sick. Frank was too sick. Ever since he went into, he didn't go, when he was arrested in 88, he went into Rochester Medical Center, Mayo Clinic. He did not go into the prison. And he had cancer of the, I think it was kidneys and then prostate, and it started riddling his body. And eventually it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. Operation after operation after operation, and he did get out, but he was in real bad shape when he got out.
So is he dead now?
Oh, yeah. He died in 08.
That's what I thought. Lombardo's in jail, basically, for the rest of his life.
Yeah, he's in a terrible unit. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but he's in what they call a SAMS unit, and he's in North Carolina. I keep track of him on the BOP a lot. He is allowed no mail, no phone calls, no visitors, nothing.
Wow.
He just lives in a room, a cell, where they slide your food underneath the door. There's a shower in there. You don't go out, nothing. That's it.
Man.
And because of his mental state, if you look on the internet, you can see his appeal. But if you look at his mental state, it's bad, and so is his physical state.
How old?
So
are, how old
I don't know
is
why
he
he's hanging on. He's just. I'm really not sure. JL's got to be. I'm not really that sure. He was born, I think, in 1937, 1938. Yeah.
He was around there. He was a bit younger than those older guys like Iupa and Cerrone and them. So he would have been just a kid during the war, and I would say he was in his
80s. Yeah, he's in his 80s now.
Or that Korean War generation,
well, in his 80s.
Rather than the World War II generation.
And by that time, he was a convicted felon, so they couldn't take him to war anyway.
Yeah.
Did you ever go back to Chicago?
So, you know, it was, do I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever gone back to Chicago?
Do I go to Chicago? Yes. Oh, yeah, many times. Many, many times.
I was reading the chapter there in the book where you walked out of the court. It said you just walked out of the court there, and after you were done at the trial, and then some of the FBI agents walked up on you.
Actually, that was Tom Knight. He was a U.S. attorney. They didn't want me walking to the cafeteria where defense attorneys or anybody could be. They didn't want me doing this. They really restricted my activities a lot. But it was during Oktoberfest. I just got on the elevator, went downstairs, and there was a bunch of people that brought worse than beer. I just walked amongst the crowd. And Tom followed me down. Tom Knight, he was the prosecutor on that case. And he followed me down, and he said, he was real casual about it. And he said, how you feeling? I said, okay. And I said, I just don't like being cramped up like this. It's terrible, you know. And so he said, I'm here. And I said, neither one of us are armed, so I don't think anything's going to happen in this big crowd. There must have been maybe 2,000 people down there. So we were rubbing shoulders around Mayor's Row and all kinds of places. They're gone now. All those places are gone.
Well, Red, you have had quite a life. Do you ever look back and just think, oh, my God, how did I survive all that?
No, I don't. Other people ask me that question.
I can imagine.
I never expected to live past after I went in the Marine Corps. I never expected to come home. And then it was like at age 30, I never thought I'd make it past that. Age 40, it was over. I pulled the plug on the whole operation, which really aggravated the FBI. They wanted me to stay undercover for a long time. They were going to get as much mileage out of me as they could.
I bet.
And I said, no way, I'm through.
And how long did it take you when you finally decided, like, hey, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write these stories down and put them in a book? How long did that take you? Or I should say, when did you start and how long did that take?
Really, I was encouraged many years ago in the 90s by John Flood to write a book, and by John Drummond. John Drummond was really the first one during 1989. To actually said, you should write a book about your life because it's very interesting. And John Drummond is John the Bulldog Drummond, CBS News in Chicago. I had some help, and over the years, I put it down and put it back and put it down and put it back. Other things happened. I was brought in on other cases. And so things got complicated in my life. What really cracked it, though, was when I started reading about myself in other books and newspaper columns, and the things were not true. They weren't accurate. And there wasn't anything I could do about it. They made me look out to be a real bad guy. I'm not a good person. And I didn't like it. And so I said, someday I'll get the record straight. Eventually, the draft, even though it was published at this date, the draft was out like 2 years before.
And 2 years later.
Do I regret it? No, I don't regret it. I think that the story should really be out there and the truth should really be out there. And the message is that I would like to give to people is if you see something going wrong, especially in these hard times that we got now, not just the mob, everything. If you see something that looks wrong, report it. Don't be a nobody, because nobody cares. And that's where I came up with the title of my book.
233 pages of just astounding accountings of events that occurred there in Chicago. It's not even broken into chapters, really. It's just stories. My other visit, I get out of town.
Yeah, and the truth of the matter is, that was like 600, that was like 600 some odd pages, but my publisher cut it down and said, that's too big of a book.
Red, you really have another book.
I'm working on a second one now. I'm working on a second one right now.
Yeah, you must have another book or two in you then.
We'll look forward to that next book. I'll look for you on Facebook.
Thank you so much.
You've got a Facebook page,
well,
right?
Yes, I do.
And how would one find that Facebook page? Just run Red Wilmette.
Well, if you're on Facebook, it's on Red Wilmette. But there's also another thing on there that said, nobody cares and what I did about it.
That's what
I
was
thinking.
That's
another
page. You had a book page. And then there's another
page that friends that like nobody cares and what I did about it. So there's three of them on there.
All right. And of course, I see you being commented on all the time, and you will make comments on that Chicago Outfit Facebook page that guy runs. What's his name? Is it David Byrne?
Mike Byrne.
Or Mike Byrne, yeah. That's a pretty good one.
Mike Byrne.
He's a good guy, and he does a lot of work. He puts out the most interesting newspaper articles. He really puts some energy into that Facebook page and reporting on the Chicago Outfit. So if you guys out there are interested...
He really does. Mike is a great guy.
He is.
Mike, when I first went to that room... there were people that called me a rat and called me all kinds of names.
I remember that. He straightened about
Mike
quick.
Mike kicked him out of the room.
I know. I saw that. I watched that. He straightened about pretty quick.
It's great, though.
A lot of people have told me I'm a very brave man.
You are.
For doing what I did. I didn't think about it that way. I never did.
We're talking with William Red Wilmette, the longest organized crime undercover informant for the FBI in the U.S. history, who've spent 18 years as an FBI mole, sharing with you, GanglandWire.com fans, his take from the mouth of the men that did it, Red Wilmette, telling us about the Chicago way of doing business.
Right. And if you want to get his book, of course, it's at his website. He would like for you to come to his website and he'll personalize it for you. It's www.redwemette.com. That's redwemette.com. And of course, it's in the other usual places, Amazon and Barnes and Noble. All right, Red. Well, thanks a lot for calling in, and we will let you know when we get this out there.
And we definitely have to stay in touch because we don't know when your next book is coming out, but we'd definitely like to talk with you again if we get the chance when that does come out.
Yeah, I will certainly let you know.
All right, Red.
I'll certainly let you know when it's coming.
Okay.
And thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. And as usual, if you have a friend, relative, or if you yourself have a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900, or go to www.firstcallkc.org. Aaron, what do you think about Mr. Wilmette? He's a character, isn't he?
Wilmette. You know, he's got some amazing stories, and as we were talking with him here, Gary had gotten an autographed copy of his book.
I did. I went to his website and got a personally autographed copy.
Copy of his book, and you can do that, too. It says here, Gary, it was nice to speak to you, Red. And Gary brought the book in tonight as we were talking with Red, and I was kind of browsing through because I never got the chance to read the whole book. And like I said, it's not really chapters, it's stories. And it's just an amazing amount of stories that this guy has and details and people that you know from the Chicago Outfit. And it amazes me that the guy's got a website and a book, and he had a contract on his life.
He testified against one of the most feared hitmen in Chicago Outfit history, Frank the German Schweiss. That guy was bad, man. Bad.
And you would think they've got a long memory. So even though it's been like 28 years.
I know. Well, you know, Frank Culotta, he's the same way. He was going to testify against Tony Spilotro, who was one of the baddest of the bad also. And now Spilotro's dead, but he had plenty of friends and relatives around who were still alive, I'm sure, some of them. And Frank Culotta, he's given
tours.
Mob tours in Las Vegas.
He's got his own mob museum now.
They had a little discussion on this Chicago Outfit Facebook page one day, and somebody asked, well, could Frank Culotta come back and just walk around Chicago? And Frank got on there pretty soon, and he said, well, hell yes, I'd come back and walk around Chicago.
He might not tell anybody.
No, I think he would. I don't know. It's so different now. That's how much power the mob's lost. They just can't get away with shit anymore. You know why? Because they don't own the police departments and the courts like they used to, especially in Chicago. You know, he's talking about that Operation Grey Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I read that book. They owned those court systems. If you were in, like Red said, he was not Whistling Dixie. If you were in, you walked from a murder. It was unbelievable.
How many times that would happen?
It happened all the time. It happened at will. If they accidentally got the goods on them, and some honest policeman actually put together a case, then they just, like he said, they asked for a judge only trial, a bench trial, and they got the right judge and just paid him off, and he just fined him not guilty.
Yeah, and so then when Grey Lord came down and the judges were kind of swept clean.
Right.
The court system recovered from that, if you will. And then now, I mean, obviously the mob got fractured, because it used to be, I thought, nobody talked.
Yeah.
That was a code of silence. The code of silence is don't write a book.
Right.
Don't.
Not only are they talking, they're writing books.
Yeah, they're like, hey, can I get a book deal and a movie deal now?
Well, and you know, there's a couple of real deal mob guys, and we'll get Frank to call in one of these days.
Yeah, we've got to talk to
Frank. And I know a couple of others, too. This Calabrese, who was, he's got a heck of a story. I hope I can get him to call in. I kind of know him, but not really. He was at the mob con the same time. He was part of that family secrets trial. He actually wore a wire on his own father, who was a maid guy in the Chicago outfit. And then there's this Andrew Donato, who was a member of the Gambino crime family, a kind of a lower level guy in New York, and he's written a book. So and I've talked to him before.
So we've really got some competition from the mouth of the men that did it.
Well, there's our support. We're not in competition with us. They're our support. We'll keep those coming at you, folks.
Yeah, if they've got a book, we want to talk to them for sure.
Yeah, and they want to talk to us because they want an audience. They want people to buy their book. And people want to know about these books. You know, sometimes, you know, in this era of self-publishing, these guys, you know, like Andrew DiNonato, he got Denny Griffin to help him write his book. And it's they've got a small publishing company, but it's not a big-time publishing company that then spends, you know, $100,000 to advertise the book so you don't know about it unless you really search them out. And Calabrese is the same way.
If you're a fan of true crime, what you need to do, if you're listening to this and me and Gary Jenkins talking, is go and subscribe to the iTunes. You also need to share ganglandwire.com with your friends and other people that maybe don't know about these true crime stories from the mouth of the men that did it. And then you need to give us a comment, like airline hijacker Martin J. McNally did about the two-episode series we did on D.B. Cooper and Martin J. McNally that led us to a multi-session interview with him, of which you can listen to the first episode. It's up online right now at ganglandwire.com. And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. I wanted to put Red's porn shop in the map, but we never got a chance to say that. Every time we talk with somebody and they tell us these stories, it's like new information's coming out. And that's one of the reasons you need to listen. But I always wanted to kind of encourage Gary to add those things to the Gangland Wire, or the Kansas City Mob Tour app, so they can take their own personal tour of Kansas City and the notorious mob locations here and maybe in other cities around the United States.
All right. Well, I think that does it. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, everybody.
You Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.